Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
The thing that I would have put in the book that I didn't had I seen the first, 70 days of this administration, is that I did not go after Elon Musk hard. I mentioned him a couple of times and I kind of around the edges a little bit, but like I would find one law that I would say needs to be repealed that was basically like, stop Elon Musk. Like that, the whole chapter would be like, how to send Elon Musk to the moon and never get him back. Like, I did not fully, even through the election, even through the campaign, I did not fully appreciate what kind of outsized influence he would have as a non-governmental official, as an allegedly just an advisor. I didn't fully anticipate the kind of impact he would have on the administration and thus on the country.
Welcome back to Just the Facts with me, Jill Winebanks, the Watergate girl. And I have a very special guest today, and you're going to really love this show. I have Ellie Mistel, who is an American political commentator and a writer who used to practice law. He's the justice correspondent at The Nation, where he writes about the courts and the criminal justice system. And he has written two books. Let Me Retort was his first. And now he has a new one out that we're going to be talking a lot about today. And that is called Bad Law. I just finished reading it, and I can't wait to talk to him about it and have you share in that discussion. And Ellie, my intro of you, of course, does not even begin to capture who you are and what you are. You are a genuinely funny lawyer and commentator. You're smart, and everybody knows that. Your language is usually over the top, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But before we talk about bad law and what we can do about it, I have a couple of preliminary questions, which is, I'm sure everyone has seen you millions of times on MSNBC, but we met and became friends at Politicon, which is, of course, my producer now is Politicon, but they used to have a live, I don't know what you would call it, just a series of discussions with political commentators and politicians, and it was really fabulous. And we met there, and then we've met in the studios of MSNBC in New York. But we always talk politics and law, and now I want to talk about you. So I want our audience to know you, not just the you who graduated from Harvard undergrad and law school, but talk about, you know, your life, your wife, your kids. Did you ever practice law?
Yes, I did. First of all, hello. It's nice to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on. My story is somewhat not linear, but not terribly complicated for a Harvard law grad. You know, I went to law school, and when I was done, apparently they expected me to pay for all of that education, which I did not realize was going to happen. And you know, at that time, there are jobs that you can take that will pay that debt down. And those are usually what we call big law, you know, white shoe firms working on Wall Street, working for the man, as it were. And so I took one of those jobs. I went to Debevoise in Plimpton, which is
one of the white shoeest of white shoes, right? For sure.
Which is a firm that thankfully has not rolling over for Donald Trump quite yet. I'm not saying they won't. I'm saying they haven't yet.
Sign on to support Jenner and Block in its opposition?
They did not. I was scanning that 500 law firm document for them, and I was very disappointed to not see them there.
Yeah.
So I did
pressure them, please. It's important.
We need every law firm that we, and it's also, we'll talk about this later, I'm sure. I did that for a couple of years. I really didn't like it. and that's no slam on Debevoise. I thought Debevoise, especially in the kind of associate meat grinder, I thought they treated me as well as people get to be treated in that job. It just really, really wasn't for me. Yeah. And so I quit that job. I decided that I wanted to transition from law to journalism. And I got a couple, you know, odd jobs here, a couple of opportunities there, but my big break came with Above the Law. I was brought on as an associate editor for Above the Law, which was a legal magazine kind of focusing on industry news and what have you. And I did that for 11 years until I moved over to my current job at The Nation. And the thing about Above the Law that was great is that it was, you know, it was a blog back when blogging was cool. I was writing at the first part like 6 posts a day, right? Which is not something that I would recommend for anybody who values their mental health. But in terms of training yourself to be a writer, to be a journalist, you know, not every one of those posts are going to be winners, but throwing 6 pieces of spaghetti at the wall every day, like you start to see what sticks, what works, what doesn't work, what's funny, what's totally not funny and offensive. Like you get a sense of those things. And that's really where my writing chops came from those 11 years.
Did you actually plan to be a lawyer when you started law school? Was that your goal? And had you been thinking of that for a long time? Are either of your parents lawyers? How did you pick
law? No, not at all. I had no intention of actually, again, I practiced law because I needed money. I went to law school for 2 kind of classically dumb reasons, right? One, I was good at college and didn't want to have a real job and thought law school, well, that sounds like college too. Like, I was good at school. Let's do some more school, right? So that was one. And then the second thing was that I kind of at that time really thought that I might go into politics. My dad was a local politician. I thought I might run for office someday. It seemed intelligent or smart to go to law school to not only get a foundation in how laws were made, if I was going to ask the people to make me a legislator, but also to kind of make those connections and networking that you might need for a political campaign when you're raising money. Turned out I also, not only did I hate practicing law, I hated raising money. I was bad at it. I tried very hard to get good at it. I like my term time job was literally dialing for dollars for the college. So I tried to learn how to raise money, and I was just, it was all, you know, it's kind of thing like, oh, can you spare $50? And it's like, no. And I'm like, of course not. Why would you? It's a stupid question. Anyway, thanks for your time, sir. Like I had no sale on that. So that kind of like that more than anything killed my political career, my just inability and unwillingness to raise money. I ended up being a white shoe lawyer for 2 years.
Yeah. So I don't know how you would know this, but my path was also, I did not plan to be a lawyer when I went to law school. I planned to be a journalist. My undergraduate degree is journalism, or was journalism. And because of discrimination, sex discrimination. I was offered jobs on the woman's page, and I wanted to cover politics and law and, you know, current events. So I thought if I went to law school, I would be more attractive to an editor and that they would see me more. And so I went to law school and then hated law school, took a leave of absence after my first year, and then suddenly realized that law school actually is great training for almost anything you want to do in life. And one of the things that I thought about doing was lobbying, because in the job I got when I took a leave of absence, I did some lobbying. And I thought, oh man, well, law school really teaches you how to put together a persuasive argument. And so I'd be better at lobbying if I went back to law school. Then I graduated and thought, I have to pay back those student loans. And therefore, I'm going to practice law for a few years. And then I can be a journalist, which doesn't pay as well. So we sort of both got there. Of course, I then went back to practicing law and not doing journalism.
Somewhat famously.
Yeah, but it took me like 50 years to get back to doing journalism. But I'm very glad I did. And I'm glad that you did the same thing. So I want to talk about a couple things in your book. I mean, many things. And I'm going to hold up a picture of it with some of my tabs in it so that I can read to you and ask you questions. Everybody see the book?
Awesome.
Everybody, by the way, see Jill's pin, which is a badge that is a replica of my badge when I was the Deputy Attorney General of Illinois. I had an actual badge in a, you know, letter portfolio to hold up. And it says just the facts, which of course is what I think is important. But anyway, you talk about in your book just 10 particular laws plus the Second Amendment that you think are, well, that you think suck, right? I would say that's the polite way of saying what you say. And some of what you say rhymes with that. and we'll talk about that later. And you say that all the laws that were written before 1965 basically shouldn't exist. You want to talk about that theory and why you say that?
Yeah. So on a non-lawyer podcast, I kind of let that slide and we kind of roll with that. But on your show, I think I can do the sharpening that I do in the book of like, I don't say that they should all be repealed before 1965. I say that it should be kind of viewed as presumptively unconstitutional, right? And you well know that what I mean by that, presumptive is doing a lot of work right in that sentence, right? And all I'm basically saying is that when it comes to deference, when it comes to court judicial deference to a law or a statute or rule passed by Congress, passed by the states, if it happened before everybody was allowed to equally vote in this country, if it happened before everybody was allowed to even have the opportunity to be a representative in this country, then it's not something the court should take all that seriously, right? That the deferential treatment we give to laws passed before 1965 shouldn't really be there, right? That we should, but it's there. We're not going to go through the entire code and take with a bottle of white out. You know, we're not savages. Right? But like, if you come into my courtroom with like, oh, in 1921, white men and only white men, because only white men were allowed to vote and participate, passed this law, I'm just gonna be like, yeah, bring me something from like the 80s, right? Like, do you have anything? Do you have anything from the 80s that supports your point, counselor? Because if not, I'm not inclined to agree with you, is the general point. Now, obviously, there are some laws that were passed before 1965 that I think are good. Right. I think the 1964 Civil Rights Act is pretty good. Right. I think the Sherman Antitrust Act is pretty good. I think lots of things passed before 1965 are pretty good. But fundamentally, I do not forget the fact that before the 1965 Voting Rights Act, universal equal suffrage was not a real thing in this country. Right. The 15th Amendment meant nothing for the voting rights of Black people before the passage of the Voting Rights Act. The 19th Amendment meant nothing for the voting rights of Black women before the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So I don't start the clock on this country being an even attempted free and fair democracy until the 1965 Voting Rights Act.
And let me just point out that not only did women not get to vote until the 19th Amendment, women today are still not part of the Constitution, except in that one amendment. It says all men are created equal. Mm-hmm. The Equal Rights Amendment is hanging and really has been ratified by all the states that need to ratify it, but has not been implemented and does not make women equal parts of this. And laws have long hurt women. They have, for example, credit for women. You had to have a man co-sign. You couldn't get a loan on your own. You couldn't get a credit card. And this is in my lifetime. I'm not talking about the 1920s. Right. I'm talking about when I became a lawyer, for God's sake. So the laws have been extremely awful and discriminatory. You actually mentioned in your book in a different context, redlining and getting mortgages and something that happened to you that I think is very telling. So why don't you tell that story?
I live in a tony suburb outside of Manhattan. I had the classic story of, you know, we lived in Manhattan and we had a kid and we were like, do we want to have another kid? Sure, but where? We're running out of shoeboxes to put them in. And so we moved out of Manhattan to the suburbs. And the first house that we kind of put an offer in on in the town that we now live in, everything was going fine. Everything was going great. Offer accepted. And then the owners got to meet me, right? And it turned out to be white owners. And they met my black ass. And all of a sudden, the house was off the market, which was pretty strange, right? And the town that I am living in has been historically redlining. Redlining, for your listeners who don't know, is the process where banks wouldn't give loans to African Americans to live in certain areas. It's one of the reasons why geographically people live where they live even today, because you could get a loan to live in a black neighborhood, a quote unquote black neighborhood, but you couldn't get a loan to live in a quote unquote white neighborhood. My town was redlined. There's like a fountain in the center of town. Basically, the south side of the town was for black people. The north side of the town was for white people. So like in my town, even today, the south side of my town looks kind of like the Bronx, like some kind of like 1990s version of the Bronx, right? Pre-Giuliani version of the Bronx, right? And the north side of my town looks like it's out of the freaking Great Gatsby. Right. Like it's one of those areas. And I was trying to buy a house on the north side of town. I got the house that I wanted to buy ripped out from under me. But, you know, you overcome. I found a different house. Right. I found a different place in the same place that I wanted to live. And I just found a different house and kept it rolling. You can't let that kind of discrimination. And, you know, most black people, most women don't. You can't let that kind of discrimination stop you. You take the L. You know, you kind of can cry about it in the bathroom, but when it's time for the game time, you have to come out and still strive.
Did you think about suing?
We did. We did. Again, I'm not the only Harvard lawyer in my household, right?
Right. My wife also. Well, you haven't mentioned that, but your wife is a Harvard lawyer.
Right. Yeah. So we thought about it. At the end of the day, and I'd be interested if you've ever felt like this, like I just wasn't going to give those white folks my money. Like it just wasn't like after being denied. Right. And the thought of like going through a years long process of lawsuits and motion practice and whatever for the opportunity to give these white folks my money. Just absolutely not. I'll find somebody who wants my money and who's going to treat me equally, and they can have it. And so that's ultimately why we didn't sue, not because we didn't think we could win, but because I didn't want to win at that point.
So since you ask, I'll share a couple of stories. One is I also didn't sue when I was sexually harassed by, I don't want to identify him now, but one of the most senior people at Motorola when I was at Motorola. And it was an event that was witnessed by many people, one of whom called HR. And HR called me and said, did I want to file a complaint? And I basically said, against that officer, no. That will destroy my career here. I'll be done. I can't do it. If I do, I'll make sure I'm never in a room with him again. I will never be sitting near him again, but no, I'm not going to sue. I sometimes regret that because I'm sure he went on to assault other women. And this was a physical touching. It wasn't just harassment. And it was in front of a lot of other people, which to me demeaned me in front of them. So yeah, I didn't, but I also have advised other women. I played a lawyer who represented women before the EEOC in a television documentary. And so I then got a lot of calls from women asking for advice. And of course, I was at Jenner and Block. Yay, Jenner and Block. Thank you for suing Donald Trump and winning, as anybody else would do who gets an EO against them, like the Jenner and Block executive order, telling them that they could not have security clearances, they couldn't appear in federal court, they couldn't enter a court. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. They couldn't really afford to hire me, but I gave them sort of pro bono advice saying, you know what, find another job. You will never be happy at this place, and it will destroy your career, not just here, but you'll be considered a problem employee and you'll have trouble getting another job. And that's the truth of the matter. It's horrible, but it's true. One other quick story is I left Maytag, Motorola to work at Maytag. I was recruited by Lloyd Ward, who was the first African-American CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And he had come in as president, was just being promoted to CEO, recruited me, and he bought a house in Newton, which is where the headquarters was. And just before the closing, someone in the neighborhood walked up to him and said, oh, we're surprised you're moving here. We thought you'd want to live among your own kind. And he canceled the deal and moved to Des Moines, Iowa instead, which was a 45-minute ride to Newton. A nuisance, yes, but he just, as you felt, was like, I'm going to live where I'm desired. That's a horrible thing about Newton, Iowa. It's a horrible thing about Maytag. And there's many horrible things I could say, but...
I think those are great stories. And I think they're painful stories, but they're illustrative stories. And I think that something that I don't know that everybody understands is that when you're in the situation of the one who's being harassed, the one who's being discriminated against, you do have to, and you have the legal training. So you know what the process looks like. You're always kind of making the decision, like, do I want the rest of my life to be about this?
Right.
Do I want to bend the rest of my life around prosecuting my case? And I know I have a case, right? But then the whole rest of my life becomes this case, right? For me in the house, it was like, well, I wanted to move out of the city. I wanted to have another baby, right? And I wasn't going to be able to do that for like an extra year if I was locked horns in litigation with this racist jerk face, right? Like, or I could just move on with the rest of my life. And those are the questions that we're always asking ourselves when we are the victims of harassment or discrimination. I don't know that people who have never been on the receiving end, and especially I think people who've only been on the giving end of that, I don't think they ever calculate that, really.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Right. Well, so for our listeners who may be on the younger side, there's a lot of lessons in what Ellie and I have been talking about. And some is you got to pick your fights and you got to figure out, is the risk worth the reward? Is it worth the time and money that will be involved, even though you will win in the end? And sometimes, as with Jenner and Block suing Donald Trump, it is absolutely worth the very quick turnaround because they won almost immediately. They filed suit and within days they had a temporary restraining order. But sometimes it isn't. And you have to know when to fight and when not to. And so anyway, let's get to your book before we run out of time. And I want to say you wrote your book, you said, in part to arm people to be able to be prepared to carry on the fight. You were really writing mostly to people who agree with you, not to people who would disagree with you. And I think that was an interesting, you know, perspective. During the civil rights movement, which I'm old enough that I was part of in the 60s, I was the chair of a symposium, and I took a constitutional law class in the political science department at the University of Illinois so that I would be better prepared to make arguments that I thought would make sense, because being prepared, being forearmed makes you stronger. You don't cover, for example, zombie laws like the Comstock Act, even though you obviously would think that's a horrible law. And I worry about it maybe more than you do, because it could potentially affect women in a very dramatic way by denying contraceptive, any kind of contraceptive, let alone abortion. But I'm wondering, before we get to the things you do talk about and that you want to repeal, your book was finished before the worst of Donald Trump, before inauguration. And so I'm wondering, are there a few things that you would have put in the book if you had known what was coming?
Okay, so I'm going to answer. I feel like those are three questions, and I want to answer all three of them because they're all okay. Super interesting to me. Really quickly on the Comstock Act, no, I'm worried about that too. But one of the reasons why I didn't include it in the book was because it's almost like I didn't want to give that the credit of being an actual law. Like, it's like to say that the Comstock Act needs to be repealed at some level accepts the premise that the Comstock Act is still a thing that can be enforced. And it's not. It just isn't. It's something that Jonathan Mitchell made up in a fever dream. And I just kind of almost refuse to give him that much credit. Like, the Comstock Act is ridiculous. It's unconstitutional. And God help us if the Supreme Court doesn't see it that way. So that's number one. Number two, on the persuasion point, like, as we've almost been talking, like, I spent a lot of my career, I spent a lot of my life trying to persuade people, right? I was the kid in college and law school that was always, like, going to take classes with the most conservative or Republican professors I could find because I wanted to hear the best version of the argument I disagreed with, right? And I wanted to kind of test myself, hone myself against, you know, the best people who were making the arguments that, you know, so every time George Will, conservative columnist, showed up to teach a class, I was like in the seminar, right? I was like, let's go, George. Show me what you got, right? So I valued persuasion a lot in my life until 2016.
Right? So you don't listen to Fox News now.
Right. And at that point, I used to have debates on Above the Law with Kayleigh McEnany. Before her turn to the dark side, I would argue. And again, she was at every point a Christian conservative Republican woman, right? But like being a Christian conservative Republican woman who like wants to see Ted Cruz elected, and joining Trump's junta, those are two different things. And I think that one of the things that Trump did, one of the ways that Trump radicalized me, was that he made me understand that there were people that not only I could not get, that it was truly a waste of my precious time on this earth trying to argue with, right? Like, if you are a Trump voter and you are gettable, you ain't going to be gettable by me. You're not listening to the loud black guy with the crazy, like, that's not, you're going to be listening to your brother or your cousin or whatever. It ain't going to be coming for me anyway, right? So that's really when I started to shift from trying to persuade gettable potential Trump voters to, as I say in the book, trying to arm people who already agree with me, people who already agree that we should live in a multiracial, multi-ethnic society based on fairness and equality, and talk about how we can be pulling the rope perhaps differently, perhaps more efficiently, perhaps smarter than we are right now to fight these people, right? So that's kind of the 2016, 2017, that was the big kind of radicalization of my persuasive life. And then to that leads to your last question about like the things that I might have included in the book that I didn't. You figure my hard draft was in before Joe Biden's first debate, right? Yeah. So it wasn't like I was under a lot of illusions about what could happen. I always knew that Trump could be elected. And I think that I wrote that, I didn't exactly write the book thinking that he absolutely would be elected, but I certainly didn't write the book thinking that there was no chance, right? So I think I protected myself well on both sides there. The thing that I would have put in the book that I didn't, had I seen the first, 70 days of this administration, is that I did not go after Elon Musk hard. I mentioned him a couple of times and I kind of around the edges a little bit, but like, and I still don't know what that law is, but like, I promise you, if I was writing it today, I would find one law that I would say needs to be repealed that was basically like, stop Elon Musk, like that. The whole chapter would be like, how to send Elon Musk to the moon and never get him back. Like, I did not fully, even through the election, even through the campaign, I did not fully appreciate what kind of outsized influence he would have as a allegedly non-governmental official, as an allegedly just an advisor. I didn't fully anticipate the kind of impact he would have on the administration and thus on the country.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that have changed. Even if you had read Project 2025 before, and I ran into the same problem.
Which I did.
My book came out March of 20. So he had just been inaugurated. And I wrote the epilogue literally after the election. As it was at the printer, I was still writing the epilogue because, and I have to say, if I look at the epilogue now, it's still pretty accurate, even 8 years later with him, you know, having served 4 years and been out for 4 years. And so it just is one of those things of, you know, COVID hit right then. I mean, it was, anyway, it's one of those things where I don't think we can ever predict what's going to happen. Who could predict the tariffs that he would have no brain about, no thinking, no logic to what he's done? But let's talk about, because you mentioned that you briefly mentioned Elon, and I'm going to go to one of the things you want to take care of, which is deregulation of airlines. And it's really ironic because you mentioned people who were all part of Watergate. Phil Bakes was on the Watergate team. Stephen Breyer, Justice Breyer, and his younger brother Stephen, who is a judge in San Francisco Federal District Court, and Bork is sort of a Watergate figure.
Oh yes,
Breyer and Breyer and Bakes were on our team. Bork was on the Nixon team, and he's the one who actually fired Cox in the Saturday Night Massacre. So it was like really funny to read and think about deregulation of airlines and how it was related to all those people who I knew. So I particularly loved that chapter. And of course, now with planes falling out of the sky and, you know, traffic controllers, heaven knows what's going to happen, who's going to be fired next. We have to seriously worry about what's happened. So talk about what you think went wrong, why it happened, and what we could do about it even now.
So yeah, I'm happy to talk about airline deregulation, but I can't let that, what you just said, lie, because that is also kind of the point that I'm trying to make. I don't think a lot of people understand just how small the community is here, just how like incestuous the community is here. You're talking about Bork and Breyer on the in the Watergate context. These people knew each other. These people hung out. These people had a drink at the Hay Adams, you know, after a hard day's work. You know, it's a very, the legal kind of apparatus in this country is very, very small. I always say, you know, if you, people remember perhaps during the Ketanji Brown Jackson confirmation hearings, there was a really tense moment between Jackson and Ted Cruz, who was questioning her. There was a lot of electricity during Ted Cruz's questions. And I kept pointing out, dude, they went to law school together. They've been having that fight for 30 years, right? That's a fight that they had on the Cambridge Common when they were in their 20s. Y'all just saw it in the Senate confirmation room, right? I went to law school with Tom Cotton. Man, if you put me in the Senate Judiciary Committee and you had Tom Cotton questioning me, it would sound like it was the Jets and the Sharks, like, because that's how far back. It's a very, very small group of people, really, that are making most of the decisions, right?
And interesting. So
I always try to tell people when they say like both parties are the same, no, they're not. That is wrong. That is a reductive way of thinking. But it is true that both parties kind of are filled with people from a, you know, very similar socioeconomic cultural stock, right? Like we're like that. We come from all these different places, but many of us get shoveled through the same institutions and the same kind of training. And that does lead to a lot of potential, at least the potential of groupthink, which I think is one of the reasons that the country can sometimes, to me, veer so very, very off course, because it's the same like 8 people who have been trained by the same 15 professors who are, you know, doing the same. It's like, man, you need to like, you know, do something, you know, go hike a mountain, man, like talk to a Sherpa, like get some new experiences in your life, man. So I didn't want to leave that lie, because that's such a, it's so great to point out that these people literally worked together, not just on the act that I'm talking about in the book, but in so many other ways in their life.
And Phil went on to be president of an airline.
Continental, of really, Eastern and then Continental, right? Yeah. And that's one of the points about the chapter
but,
in the book.
But right? let's talk about, I mean, you do mention things like immigration and election law, but deregulation of airlines, why does anybody care? Why should anybody listening to this care about that being one of the 10 things that you would point out needs to be repealed?
It gutted labor. It gutted labor. And if you think about the Democratic Party, how the Democratic Party likes to think of itself as the party of the working man, the gutting of unionized labor in this country is why the Democrats fail, is why the Democrats have lost the alleged white working class man to the Republicans. And that the losing of the unions, losing labor, that starts with deregulation. The idea now, Jill, we call it privatization, right? We call it the privatization of forces. But back in the day, we called it deregulation. It's when you take an industry that is meant to provide a government service for everybody, and you take the government out of it and you give it to the market, which does not have an incentive to provide a service for everybody. It has an incentive to make as much money as possible. When you switch a government service into a market service, you lose a lot. You lose a lot of customer benefits. You lose a lot of consumer protections. But most importantly, you lose protections for labor. And then if you think about airline deregulation, the reason why I focused on that form of deregulation is because it was generally the first. Right. Every other deregulation that's happened, the deregulations of the phone companies and the telecommunications industry and the banking industry, happened after they deregulated the airlines. So it is, you know, patient zero. It is Typhoid Mary on the deregulation track. And it fits with the rest of the book, because I'm talking about popular laws. every law that I talk about enjoyed broad bipartisan support when it passed, and airline deregulation is no different. It was conceived of by kind of arch conservative Republican Nixon hatchet man Robert Bork. But as we've already talked about, it was promoted by liberal pragmatist Justice right. Stephen Breyer, Phil Banks, and Ted Kennedy, who is, you know, the lion of the Senate, right? The lion liberal of the Senate. Ted Kennedy and Robert Bork on the same path for deregulation. That's not only a wild story, it's a story about how Democrats lost the working class in this country.
And you also, I mean, you do blame Democrats in large part for this. You mentioned, you quote something from Bill Clinton. You said, he said, the era of big government is over. So that, to me, is the exact opposite of what Democrats stand for. Big government is over is what I associate with Republicans. How did that come to be something he said, and what did it mean?
Well, from the Democrats' perspective, from Clinton's perspective, you got to remember Clinton is running after 12 straight years of Republicans having the White House on lockdown, right? 2 years of Reagan, 1 year of Bush. He believed, as many did at the time, that the Republicans had won the argument about regulation, about deregulation, right? That it won the argument that the markets were better than the government in providing government services. And so instead of fighting that argument, he capitulated to it. And he said that the problem with our services is that we have too much government, not that we have inefficient government, which is something that I would have agreed with, not that we have government that needs to be streamlined and made more efficient and made more responsive to the concerns of the people, which is something that I agree with, but just that government itself is the problem. And that is, Clinton gets that not from any, you know, not from FDR, not from LBJ. Clinton gets that from Ronald Reagan. He is, when Clinton says the era of big government over, he is stealing a Reagan line and updating it for the 90s. And it is, again, it is how the Democrats lost labor. It's how the Democrats lost the working man in this country.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair has got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
So listen to that, all you politicians, and start thinking about it. But there are so many topics, and I'm just concerned about time. You talk about mass incarceration. You talk about repealing the firearms dealers' protection against any kind of tort lawsuit. And I may come back to that, but I want to skip ahead to one where I'm not sure I agree with you. And I know you're dangerous to take on in argument. So I want to listen to what you have to say and see if you persuade me more than in the book. And that is on felony murder. And so, first of all, let me just explain to anyone listening what that means. Basically, felony murder, in the most simple but accurate way, is making someone who participates in a crime, who doesn't have a gun, didn't intend to kill anybody, responsible if someone gets killed in the course of committing that felony. So you're the getaway driver, and you're waiting for the bank robber to come out, and you're expecting to come out with bags of cash. And instead, he comes out with a fired shotgun and some cash, and he's killed a guard. You are now responsible not just for the robbery, which you would have been responsible for, but also for the murder. And you think that is horrible and unfair and unjust. And before I tell you why I don't agree and what I think the answers are, I want to hear you explain why you think that that is true without resorting to what I would call absurdly extreme, unrealistic examples of how this could play out.
So my fundamental premise with felony murder is that people should be charged and criminalized for things that they do, not things that other people do. That justice requires that we charge people for something they actually did. And in the felony murder situation, and as you've already kind of pointed out to your listeners, I'll just put a pin in this as well. We already have laws for people who are accomplices to murder, for people who aid and abet murder. I'm not talking about taking away any of those laws. If you can prove that somebody significantly aided a murder, helped a murderer get away with it, or was in some other way critical to the murdering operation, mm-hmm. I'm all for you being charged with murder and being that's something that you did. Felony murder attaches for the situation where we cannot make a case that the person had any intent to murder or desire to murder or did anything to help the murder other than just be there while committing another felony. So I think that as a first principles, charging people for something that they did not do because somebody else did it is wrong. Going a little bit deeper than that, though, when we look at felony murder laws, what we find is that they are some of the most racist and sexist laws that we have, because we find that on the sexism point, most of the women who are in jail for quote unquote murder are there for felony murder, right? In this country. And what you have, I'll use the exact same example you did. You are the getaway driver for a bodega robbery gone wrong. And your person has gone into the store. He was supposed to just get cash. Instead, he shoots the cashier and comes out with a little bit of cash. You're the driver, right? In a man-woman situation, oftentimes you could argue that that is a survival act for the woman. You could argue that a lot of times in a felony murder situation, the woman is in an abusive relationship and she had no real choice other than to, what would have happened to her if she hadn't taken the wheel and driven the car. So again, charge her for the robbery that she was a part of, that she was literally aided and abetted the robbery. But ratcheting on a murder charge for something that I might argue is a survival action seems fundamentally unjust to me, especially when you can just charge the person who shot the guy for shooting the guy.
Okay, so let me ask some questions. First of all, I'm a prosecutor. I had many, many trials, and I know about prosecutorial discretion and jury nullification. And so I'm not worried about that person being convicted. First of all, depending on the extreme situation of you can prove that this person was, Patty Hearst, who was actually brainwashed by the Sibian Liberation Army. I may have the name wrong, but a wealthy heiress who was kidnapped and then brainwashed and who participated in crimes. No jury will convict. I shouldn't say no jury will, but it's very likely that with good legal representation, you will not be convicted. But it's also very likely that you won't even be indicted because the prosecution will see that you are a good witness for them and that you aren't a very good defendant. So I trust in both of those legal realities to say that felony murder does not unfairly. In most cases, these are people, again, the getaway driver is usually someone who, he's part of, or she is part of, is part of the, and let me turn my phone off, which I thought I had done, is part of the planning of the burglary. They know that the person going in has a gun. That raises the risk that something is going to happen that will cause them to use the gun. I don't think it's unfair to therefore hold them responsible any more than it is to hold anybody in conspiracy law. If you sit down and say, yeah, let's plan this out. I'll get the blueprints for the building so you know how to enter it. And that's the end of your participation. You still are responsible for whatever happens during the entry of that building. And that seems to me totally fair. It does not seem unfair. So I would say in general, sure.
Just on the blueprints thing, I would say that you are aiding and abetting the murder. And again, we have laws for that. But you were
you're aiding and abetting the murder by driving the car that got them there and by driving that person away. Assuming that person gets in your car and you drive that person away, you're aiding and abetting.
So you were a prosecutor. You were a good prosecutor. You were a fair prosecutor. And you, in your prosecutorial discretion, do not believe that Patty Hearst, she wasn't charged, would have been charged, that a person similarly situated to Patty Hearst would be charged. And even if she was charged, the jury would nullify that charge. Can you really sit there and tell me that you're sure that the same prosecutorial discretion would happen if we're not talking about wealthy heiress Patty Hearst, but we're talking about poor Patrika Howard, you know, the black woman in D.C. that's in the exact same situation, but doesn't have Patty Hearst's privileges?
Well, there's a difference between how it is applied, and you make a very compelling case about the racial and sex disparity between those who are charged with felony murder and those who are not charged with felony murder, but who actually pulled the trigger. And our laws are applied in racially horrible ways. There's no question about that. But that seems to me a different problem that isn't solved by abolishing felony murder. And that sometimes it's a warning to people. If you participate in a felony, you can be responsible. Yes, we can go to you mentioned in your book some extreme examples, but you know, we can take Breonna Taylor, who ends up dead because of police shooting. And her boyfriend is not charged with felony murder, but could have been, as you point out, because he engaged in shooting at the police who he thought were breaking into his house. He did not know they were police. He wasn't the person for whom a warrant was issued. I mean, everything went wrong in that particular case. But the fact that that case is everything goes wrong doesn't mean that in 99% of them it goes wrong. I would say that felony murder serves a purpose and needs to be applied fairly. And it, you know, as is true of all our laws, you know, I live in a community that is doing reparations. We are paying reparations because of redlining that existed, obviously, hundreds of years before I bought my house. But my community is one that believes that we should make recompense for the bad things that happened. I just don't see how felony murder, out of all the things you could have picked, is one that I would have picked. I think that it serves a real purpose.
I see that. So my final argument, though, on this is always, I do this for people who haven't read it yet, I try to do this consistently in the book, and I do it in this chapter as well. I point out that we're the only country that has it.
Yes.
Right? All the other common law countries, felony murder is I don't want to bore people with the legal backstory, right? But it's a common law principle that, so we get it from ye old England, you know, sometime back when the Magna Carta was written or whatever. But all the other Commonwealth countries, you know, England, Scotland, Ireland, all of them, Australia, they've all gotten rid of their felony murder rule. And Canada in the 90s ruled it straight up unconstitutional. So my final argument is that other countries have figured out that they can still prosecute crime and still charge criminals for their actions without having this extra rule that can, at least I think we would agree, sometimes lead to unjust outcomes.
Well, we both agree that unjust outcomes are possible. I just think that there are fewer that we are justified in having that particular law, as opposed to, you talk about, for example, stand your ground and the castle doctrine. And I don't know that we're going to have time to talk about that. I'm going to move to, you talk about repealing the Second Amendment with the admission that there is no chance that that is going to happen. So maybe it's not worth talking about because it is not going to happen. And then you talk about the Hyde Amendment, which, and Hyde was a congressman from my state, Illinois, and he was vehemently against abortion and passed a financial attachment to the budget saying that no federal money could be used to support abortion. And it has been adopted every year in every budget since then. And what it really means, it doesn't stop abortion, although now the Supreme Court has. But what it does is it means that if you don't have the money to pay for it, the abortion, or to travel to obtain an abortion to a state that hasn't, under the Supreme Court's Dobbs case, barred you from doing it where you live, that you cannot get an abortion. And it also affects military because they've applied it to the DOD budget, et cetera. So that's one that would be easy to change if there was any will in Congress basically to do anything these days. So that one I think is worth talking about because that is something that maybe pressure from the public, and I still believe in the power of the people. I saw it work in the Vietnam War. I saw it work in civil rights. I saw it work in Watergate. So I saw signs. I marched on Saturday with the hands-off march, and we had 20 to 30,000 people in Chicago, which is amazing. It was fabulous. And there were signs saying, the people have the power. So talk about Hyde Amendment and what people listening might do to get rid of the Hyde Amendment.
The Hyde Amendment is, as you point out, a budgetary rider that is attached to every omnibus spending bill since 1976. All we have to do to repeal it is to refuse to pass a budget that includes the Hyde Amendment. And by we, I first mean Democrats. First mean Democrats because while it's a Republican idea and a Republican plan, it is something that Democrats have gone along with every single year. I make the argument in the book that it's one of the reasons why abortion rights have been lost is because Democrats never really defended them, right? The Hyde Amendment makes abortion services are the only thing that is legal for you to have that it's illegal for the government to help you have. It's the only thing. Everything else that is legal for you to do, the government is legally allowed to provide assistance to do it if you are poor, except abortion services. So not only, as you point out, does it not in any way impact abortion services for rich women, it only impacts abortion services for people who need Medicaid, who need government assistance for their medical bills. It also, in this post-Dobbs world, arguably prevents the federal government from providing needed health care in states that have gone full Handmaid's Tale and are refusing to provide health care for sick women who happen to be pregnant, right? So if you just took this one amendment away, this one, again, budgetary rider away, I always want to say budgetary rider because sometimes when I say amendment, people are just like, it's in the Constitution. Yeah. No, it ain't. Absolutely not. Nowhere. Right? It's just a budgetary rider. If you take that away, not only do you open the aperture for poorer women to receive needed health care, you also open the huge power of the federal government to provide services in states where currently those services are illegal or greatly restricted. It is. I also want to restore Roe v. Wade. I'm also for the legal codification of abortion rights. I'm not sure that the current Supreme Court lets us do that.
Right.
I do not think that if you pass a national abortion bill, I don't think that John Roberts and his other conservative friends would let you do that. But if you took away the Hyde Amendment, the federal government could provide these services without the need of a national bill.
You also point out, which I thought was very clever, that it would be possible even under the Hyde Amendment, which says you can't use funding for abortion, that you could use funding to transport people to places where abortion is legal 100%. And get them out of the state. And I thought that was, I like that idea of the using first
thing,
federal
if
money.
If I was Joe Biden after Dobbs, the first thing I would have done would be right. like federal abortion rideshare services, let's go.
Right. But of course, we're in a different world now. I also was under the delusion that maybe Donald Trump, who said he wanted to help women, whether we wanted it or not, might actually get a joint resolution eliminating the one argument that I think is not right and not persuasive, but is the argument that seems to be holding back the Equal Rights Amendment, and that is that there's a timeline that has expired, that he could get a joint resolution to eliminate that, and that that's how he would help women. Oh, man, was I delusional thinking that Donald Trump would do anything to help women? No, he won't. Sorry, that's a diversion. But, you know, there are just... You're going to have to come back. Would you come back to finish talking about the other things? Because, I mean, the Second Amendment I want to talk about. I want to talk about don't say gay and book banning. And you even talk about how you were worried that you, I mean, well, let's talk about your language. You use a lot of...
vulgarities.
Yes, thank you. Vulgarities. And I mean, I am, listen, I'm a prosecutor, so I've heard every word that you could possibly say. And so it doesn't offend me in the slightest bit. It doesn't do anything to me. But, you know, if you're thinking about getting your book banned because of vulgarity, and nowadays they're banning books for God knows, no reason or any reason. And I have to say, I have caved in. I'm working on a children's book, and I use the word gender in some respects in reference to the discrimination I faced. And I've changed that to sex discrimination because it doesn't change the meaning for me. So it's not a cop out, but it is a recognition that if you use the word gender, your book isn't going to be in libraries because mothers, what's the name of that group? Mothers Against Liberty or Mothers for Liberty?
For Liberty.
For Liberty. Yeah. Well, I don't think it's for Liberty, but okay. I guess that was a Freudian slip that it was against Liberty. It's not worth using the word. If it had a real meaning and it made a difference, I would fight for it, but it doesn't, so why do it? But that's caving in advance. And so, I mean, I think there's a lot to talk about on the Don't Say Gay bills that have passed. Particularly, you point out Florida is just horrible, which we know. You talk about the First Amendment, particularly the establishment of religion versus the free exercise. And I really, those take more time than we have left to discuss. So you have to come back and we'll talk about all the other laws and then maybe delve into more of things that have happened since you wrote the book.
Oh, yeah.
That need our attention.
Have me back in June so we can do Supreme Court decision season, because
that seems like a good idea. Okay. Thank you, Ellie. I want you back in June. We will talk about the Supreme Court and figure out how we and what little things people listening to us can do to help save our country. And I personally right now feel like I'm in 1939 Germany trying to figure out what do I do? I cannot ignore this. I can't keep saying, oh, they're not going to come for me. First of all, they are. And I, for example, I'm really worried all this anti-Semitism support, that's baloney. That's going to end up with me as a Jew getting blamed for everything else that happens bad in the country. And so don't do this in my name, please. This is not, you know, and I do believe in the First Amendment and the free marketplace of ideas. So we need to talk about all these things. And I will look forward to having you back again, Ellie. Thank you for being with us today. And thank you for being with us again in the summer.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Jill. Thank you.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.